I happen to be very into this book. I read it the first time, and I really liked it. I read it a few more times since then, so I think there's a lot to learn from it. And I also think it's particularly interesting that a lot of the things that he says, that Stephen Covey says in The Seven Habits, really sound a lot like things that we find in Torah sources. So I thought it just made sense to go through the book and to point out how so many of what he says, you know, reminds us as reminiscent of something that we find in either a Gemara or a Pasuk or something like that. So there are going to be four parts to this shiur, and I labeled it alphabetically here on the source sheet. The first part is going to be about the difficulty of breaking bad habits and the value of forming good habits. So this is going to be an introduction. Covey has an introduction that he calls an overview before he gets into the seven habits. So this will be his introduction, and then each week we'll do one of the habits. So the first topic for today is the difficulty. Hi. Seven Habits Shiur, yes. Stephen Covey, Seven Habits. We're just starting now. Perfect timing. Perfect timing. No such thing as late. Don't worry. Yeah, you can sit wherever you want. There's no machitza here. Feel free to sit wherever you want. It's very comfortable, and we're all around a table. It just creates a certain friendly nature to this.
Yeah.
So
we'd rather all be around the table?
Wherever you're comfortable.
Around the table?
Wherever you're comfortable.
Maybe there
on
the table.
Okay.
We take our chairs.
So tonight. That counts. So today we're going to be going through his introduction. So we're going to be talking about, first of all, the difficulty of breaking bad habits and the value of forming good habits. And then onto the second page, we're going to talk about what it takes to form good habits. The third part is going to be what he calls the maturity continuum of going from dependence to independence to interdependence. And then the last piece that we have on the last page is what he calls the P/PC balance, by which he means production versus production capability. And we'll see what he means by this. So the way we're going to do it is we're just going to read a quote from what he writes. And then we're going to go to see some Torah sources, which really depict basically exactly what he's saying. So to begin here, we have on page 54, in the first before the first source here, what's numbered A. So this is in the Seven Habits, page 54. He says, as Horace Mann, the great educator, once said, habits are like a cable. We weave a strand of it every day, and soon it cannot be broken. So in other words, it first starts out as like a small strand, and then after weaving a small strand every day, it becomes so strong, like a cable. I personally do not agree with the last part of his expression. I know they can be broken. Habits can be learned and unlearned, but I also know it isn't a quick fix. It involves a process and a tremendous commitment. So this idea that habits are something which are formed by small actions on a continuous basis that are represented by this metaphor of, you know, weaving strands together into a cable is actually mentioned by the Gemara. The Gemara says in Maseches Sukkah, here in the first source, the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Asi, here it's talking about bad habits. The same is true by bad habits or good habits. Amar Rabbi Asi, Yetzer Hara, B'tchila Dome Rechut Shel Bochya. The Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, originally is comparable, begins like the small string of a spider web. U'vasof Dome Ka'avosos Ha'agala, and at the end becomes like the cables that you would use to attach a horse to a wagon, to pull a wagon. Shnei Amar, as the Pasuk says, I think it's in Yeshayahu, Hoy Moshe Ha'avon Bechavrei Hashav, woe to those who pull sin upon themselves with these insignificant strings. U'cha'avos Ha'agala Chata, and who pull, again, sin, they pull sin onto them with these powerful strings, these powerful cables, like the cables of a wagon. So you see a similar idea, that the Gemara assumes that the Yetzer Hara begins as something that is as small as a strand, but after, you know, doing something many times, it becomes, you know, a habit that's really entrenched, and it becomes like a cable. And we also see an idea that's similar to this in the second source here, the Gemara in Kiddushin. The Gemara says, the Amar Rav Huna, Kevan Sha'avar Adam Aveira Vishanaba, once a person sinned once and then sins a second time, Hutralo, it becomes permissible to him. So the Gemara asks, that's strange, what does it mean it becomes permissible to him? Hutralo Salkadatach, you actually think it becomes permissible to him? Ela nasis lo keheter. What it means is that it seems to him to be permissible. In other words, he's become habituated to it. If a person does something once and then twice, so then it becomes like second nature, and then it's harder to break. So that really expresses the idea that Stephen Covey is saying, that Horace Mann said in this quote, that habits are like a cable. They start with small individual actions, but then eventually they become very strong. What that also means, though, is that on the flip side, if we're trying to break a habit, so to try and break a cable seems like something which is very, very difficult. But if the way to break a cable is to just unwind it one strand at a time, then it doesn't sound as difficult. So that's really the way to break a habit, is to view it that way. It's not something which is overwhelming. You have to snap through the cable in one shot. You just unwind it one by one. So if breaking habits are so difficult, they become as strong as a cable, so is it really worth it? Is it worth it to put in the effort to try and break that habit? So Stephen Covey writes here also on page 54, in the second quote we have here from The Seven Habits, he says, "Habits, too, have tremendous gravity pull, more than most people realize or would admit. Breaking deeply embedded habitual tendencies, such as procrastination, impatience, criticalness, or selfishness, that violate basic principles of human effectiveness, involves more than a little willpower." In other words, it's not just so easy. It involves more than a little willpower and a few minor changes in our lives. Liftoff takes a tremendous effort, but once we break out of the gravity pull, our freedom takes on a whole new dimension. In other words, it's really hard to break a habit, but it's worth it because once we do, our freedom takes on a whole new dimension. So this idea that at first it's very difficult to break through habits is expressed by a Rashi in Sefer Shmos. We see here the pasuk in source 3, Ve'ata, and now im shamoa tishmu. God says, and now if you will listen. So Rashi, picking up on the word and now, says in source 4, Ve'ata, and now im ata tekabu aleichem, if now you accept upon yourselves, yerav lachem mikan va'elach. It'll be sweet for you in the future. Because all beginnings are difficult. In other words, that liftoff that Stephen Covey is describing, that liftoff takes a tremendous effort. But once a person breaks that gravity pull, so then it becomes very worthwhile, that Yerav Lachem Mikan Ve'elach, that it'll be sweet for you in the future. Now there's an amazing Teferes Yisrael. The first time I saw this, it's a commentary on the Mishnah. The first time I saw this, I was like blown away. I don't know what the Teferes Yisrael source is for what he's about to say, but it's amazing. It's a little bit long, but it's worth it. So he writes here in Source 5, Teferes Yisrael writes, it's a little bit of a story. Kishahotzi Moshe Rabbeinu alav hashalom es Yisrael mimitzrayim. When Moshe Rabbeinu took the Jews out of Egypt. So Shamu Amim Yergozim, so the nations heard and trembled. Vayitmehu ma'od al zeha ish Moshe. Everyone was astonished about Moshe Rabbeinu. Ki al yodo nasu kol hagvuros v'hanifloos ha'elu, because through him all of these wonders and strengths were performed. He must be, Moshe Rabbeinu must be someone really special. V'lachein hit'orer melech aravi echad, so a certain Arabian king was inspired. V'yishlach tzayer muvcha l'tzayer tmunas hamaning hagodo hazeh, and so he sent one of his expert artists to draw a picture of Moshe Rabbeinu, of this great leader, l'haviu elav, and to bring that picture back to him. Vayelech hatzayer, vayitzayer tmunaso. So the artist went and drew a picture of Moshe. Vayivieyu lifnei hamelech. He brought the portrait back to this Arabian king. Vayishlach shuv hamelech. So then the king sent out. Vayavi vayosef yachdav kol chachmei charoshim asherlo. He brought together like all his wise men. Vayishalohem lifshot al pi hapartzuf panav. And he asked them to determine based on the face, the depiction of Moshe Rabbeinu in the portrait, right? Shal Moshe kfiya mitzuyar. Look at the portrait. Radas tchunas tivo midosav. And tell me, try and find out, tell me what his characteristics are. What are his midos? What are his personality traits? Uvameh kolcho gadol. How does he have such great strength? Vayashivu koach achamim yachdav el hamelech, and all of the wise men responded to the king, vayomru, and they said, im nishbar al pitzir chaster panav shel ha'ish hazeh hamefursam legadol, if we were to judge based on this picture, you know, what we think about this, what the characteristics are of this great man, this great famous Moshe Rabbeinu, nomar v'adoneinu ki hu rama al olam. The person who this picture was taken of is someone who is evil and his actions are evil. Begeyos, he's arrogant. Vechemdas hamamon, he's materialistic. Uveshrius halev, and he thinks he can do whatever he wants. Uvechol chesronos shebaolam, he has all human deficiencies possible. Uvechol chesronos shebaolam sheyivnu nefesh adam hamara, that a person can be criticized by. He has all the deficiencies. Vayiktzof hamelech maod, and the king was very upset. Vayomer, and he said, Ma ze hachitis alerubi, are you picking fun at me? Everything I've heard about this great man is the opposite. I've heard everyone speaking so highly of him. How could it be that he's so evil? So the wise men were trembling, and I guess they're afraid that the king is going to get upset at them for lying about, saying that Moshe is evil. And when the king doesn't believe that. So they humbly, quietly responded to the king. And each one was looking for excuses. The person who painted the picture was looking for excuses, and the wise men were looking for excuses. Each one was accusing the other one of making a mistake. Right? The artist said the wise men don't know how to determine a person's personality by looking at his picture. And the wise men said the artist must have made a mistake in drawing this picture, this portrait of Moshe Rabbeinu. Hatzayar Amar, the artist said, Anitziyar Tivkahogan, I depicted him correctly. V'hachachamim shagubidiyasam, and the wise men made a mistake. Their knowledge is not correct. V'hachachamim, and the wise men, Galiru Koacheshon Alatzayar, they said that the artist is not correct. Shalotziyar Tmunas Moshe Kahogan, he didn't draw a proper picture. The king who wanted to know who was right, so Nasa Berichvo, he got in his chariot and traveled to Farashav with his horses. He traveled and he came to the Jewish encampments in the desert. When he arrived, he lifted up his eyes and he saw Moshe, the man of God, from a distance, and he took out the picture. And he looked at the picture. The artist did a perfect job. This person, the picture looked exactly like Moshe Rabbeinu. Like shooting an arrow at a hair's breadth. Not missing. Perfect picture. So his heart like stopped. He was amazed. He was wondering what's going on. So he went himself to the tent of the man of God of Moshe Rabbeinu. He bowed down in honor of him. He told Moshe Rabbeinu the whole story, Asher Nasu, everything that happened. And he said to Moshe Rabbeinu, Bi Adoni, Isha Elokim, my master, man of God, Hinani Kodem Raosi Panecha, before I saw your face, Pane Elokim, like the face of an angel, a godly face, Amarti, Achulayat Sayer, Shogabim Rachto, perhaps the artist made a mistake. These wise men who have this expert ability to determine, based on a person's physical characteristics, physical features, facial features, what their personality is. I thought they were such experts, they couldn't make a mistake. But now that I see, now that I see that you look exactly like the picture, Asher Hevi Hatzayer, that the artist brought, I'm forced to determine that it's my wise men who've been betraying me all along. They've been pretending that they have this ability to see what a person's personality traits are based on their physical features, based on their facial features, and obviously they were lying to me the whole time. They really don't have any wisdom. They're just faking. I have them at my palace, eating at my table. And they've been tricking me for years with their, you know, with their nonsense. Vayan Moshe Israel Ukim Vayoma, and Moshe Rabbeinu, the man of God, answered them, Wochein, it's not true. Gam Hatzayer, both the artist, Gam Chachamecha, and your wise men, Nifroim Heim Bidi Asam V'Chachmasam, they are amazing in their knowledge and their wisdom. Uram, however, Dalecha, you should know. If not for the fact that my natural tendencies are in truth exactly as the wise men described, my natural tendencies, says Moshe Rabbeinu, are to be this evil person with every possible human deficiency. If not for that, lo tov anochi mibuleitz yavesh, then I would be no better than a piece of dry wood. A piece of dry wood also has no human deficiencies. And if so, would I be precious in the eyes of God and man if I was not born with these evil tendencies? Omnam ken yedidi, you should know, my friend. Moshe Rabbeinu says, I'm not embarrassed to tell you, all the deficiencies and weaknesses that your wise men told you about me, kulam kshurim bi b'teva, those are all who I am naturally. That's how I was born. The Efsher Od Yoser Measher Shaftu Chachamecha, and perhaps even worse than your wise men described. Vani Bekoach Amitz, and I, says Moshe Rabbeinu, with tremendous strength, Hinei His Chazakti, I strengthened myself. V'radisi V'kibashti Osam, and I conquered those tendencies, Ad Asher Kanisi Rihipucham with Tevasheni, until I acquired the opposite of those deficiencies. I acquired the opposite of all those faults, all those weaknesses, as my new second nature. V'rachein, and therefore, v'avurzeh yikarti v'hiskabarati b'shamayim imau v'aretz mitachas, and because of that, I've become precious and I've become honored in the heavens above and in the earth below. In other words, what made Moshe Rabbeinu so special? What made Moshe Rabbeinu so special is that he was born with the natural tendencies to be the worst possible human being ever created. And Moshe Rabbeinu overcame that through tremendous strength and turned himself into Moshe Rabbeinu. So, going back to what Covey says, liftoff takes a tremendous effort. We can only imagine what effort it takes to turn a person around from the way Moshe Rabbeinu was born to the way Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, developed himself into. So yes, liftoff takes a tremendous effort, but as Covey says, once we break out of the gravity pull, our freedom takes on a whole new dimension. A person can become like a Moshe Rabbeinu. I thought that that source was amazing. The first time I saw that, it's just so powerful.
True. Is that a true story? Did that happen, or is that a midrash?
So I mentioned before, I'm not sure what his source is for that. That's a very fair question. Where did he get this from? I don't know. I'll be the first to confess, I've never learned really anything mystical. So there's a whole genre of Torah sources out there that I've never seen, and that most of the people who I've studied from have never seen. So it is possible that this is sourced in something, but I just don't know. Okay. But it's amazing.
It's from Tiferes Yisrael?
Yeah, Tiferes Yisrael is a commentary to the Mishnayos, and it's the end of the Mishnah in Mishnayos in Maseches Kiddushin. So that's a non-mystical source, a very revealed Torah source. So that's the only place that I've seen this, but I don't know where it comes from. But yeah, it's amazing. I don't know. But the idea is definitely true. Even if it doesn't have an earlier source, the idea behind it is absolutely true. You know, just the ones we're talking about this, the Rambam famously says that a person has free will to choose to be like Moshe Rabbeinu or to choose to be like someone as evil as the king Yerovam ben Nevat. And Rav Eliyahu Dessler, who is a Mashgiach in Eretz Yisrael, he points out that, you know, we normally think a person has free will to do anything. And he says that that's not really true, that, you know, I don't have free will to either, on the bad side, go out and commit a murder, or on the good side, I don't know, do what Moshe Rabbeinu did and fast for 40 days and 40 nights. Neither one of those are things that I would actually contemplate doing. And Rav Dessler says, he speaks about something that he calls the point of Bechira, that a person has free will at a certain point. You know, if I have a certain test at a certain point, you know, I might, my alarm rings and I decide if I want to turn on the snooze, not turn on the snooze, come on time for Shacharis, come late to Shacharis. So that's the type of test that a person has at a specific point. If a person, you know, passes that test, then Rav Dessler explains they move their point of Bechira, they move their point of free will in the right direction. So it's not that a person right now can say, immediately, I'm going to be like Moshe Rabbeinu, or immediately, I'm going to be as bad as Yerovam ben Nevat. But Rav Dessler is explaining that a person, through making the right choices continuously, can build themselves up to Moshe Rabbeinu, or can put themselves down to the terrible level of Yerovam ben Nevat.
Sounds like those strands of the rope again.
Yes, exactly, that it's one action at a time. That would fit in very nicely with Rav Dessler's idea. Very good, I never thought of that connection. Good point. Yes, excellent. So, fine. So, I thought there are a few other sources also which express this idea that Covey says that our freedom takes on a whole new dimension when we break our bad habits. So there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that says here in Source 6 that v'omer haruchos ma'aseh elokim hema, that the ruchos, the tablets, were the act of God, that God fashioned the tablets. V'hamichtav michtav elokim hu, and the writing was the writing of God, chorus al haruchos, engraved on the ruchos. Al tikri chorus, don't read engraved elacheres. Read it as if it said free. She'em lecha ben chorin elamisha osek b'talmud Torah. You have no one who's free other than someone who studies Torah. The only one who's truly free is someone who studies Torah. What does that mean? So again, the Tiferes Yisrael explains. I really like the Tiferes Yisrael. Big fan. He's really good. So the Tiferes Yisrael explains there in Pirkei Avos, b'talmud Torah, she'rak hu eino mishtabed v'gam eino mishubad l'hagufnias. Only someone who studies Torah is not enslaved to his physicality. V'zos hacheres, that's the freedom that's the freedom that we're referring to. Shenafsho eino mishubedes l'tavas hagufni, that his soul isn't enslaved to his physical desires. Zehu revad cheres hamitis, that's the only true freedom. V'rokesh ta'avoso mishuchrar, and not when someone's desires are freed. V'nafsho mishubedes l'tava, but their soul is enslaved to their desires. So I think that fits in very nicely with the words, with Covey's words, Right? He said, once we break out of the gravity pull of our bad habits, our freedom takes on a whole new dimension. In other words, we're not enslaved to our habits. Right here, the Mishnah Pirkei Avos is referring to being enslaved to physical desires, but it's along the same lines, that a person who's not enslaved by physical desires and not enslaved by their bad habits, so that person is truly free. In other words, they can use their intellect to make the types of choices that they truly want to make, and not that they feel that some external or internal, depending on how you look at it, force is driving them to make. And beyond that, so here we've been talking so far about breaking bad habits and the freedom achieved by breaking bad habits. But as we'll see, most of the book, Kovi's going to discuss, you know, building good habits. So in the context of the value of developing good habits, so Kovi writes here, it's from page 55 on the source sheet here. He writes, it, referring to the gravity pull of some of our habits, is a powerful force. And if we use it effectively, we can use the gravity pull of habit to create the cohesiveness and order necessary to establish effectiveness in our lives. In other words, we can use habit to train ourselves to do good things. It just reminded me right now of the idea that I've learned a little bit about called pairing. That if a person wants to, there's something they want to do. Let's say they want to exercise more frequently, and they're not doing that. I'm speaking about that because I should exercise more frequently, and I really have to get back to that. But let's say they want to do that. So if a person tells themselves, okay, I'm going to exercise more frequently, so it's going to be difficult. But let's say they pair exercise together with something else, meaning let's say they say, I'm going to listen to my favorite music while I'm exercising. So then they're going to be interested in listening to the favorite music, and they sort of pair the two together. And pairing can be done both in terms of like a reward, like that example that we're talking about, pairing something that I enjoy doing together with something which I need to motivate myself to do. And pairing can also be done in terms of timing. Like let's say, you know, before I go to bed, I'm always going to do this. And then it becomes a habit that the person gets in the habit that, you know, part of their bedtime routine, before I go to bed, so I'm going to... you know, whatever it is, I'm going to read something that I always wanted to read, or I'm going to, have a snack, I'm going to exercise, you know, whatever it is the person wants to do. So a person can develop a positive habit by pairing together something that they always do with something that they want to be more motivated to do, and that can create, as Kovi says, the cohesiveness and order to establish effectiveness in our lives. That reminded me of an example. You know, we were talking before about pressing the snooze button on an alarm. It reminded me of an example that we actually find in the Kitzer Shulchan Aruch. He writes here in Source 8, So a person should get up with strength like a lion. I actually remember my mashgiach in Israel used to say that, I forgot who he was quoting from, one of his rabbis, I forgot who, but he used to say that if a person wants to fulfill the first halacha in Shulchan Aruch, that they should get up like a lion. There's something that comes before that, and that's that they should go to sleep like a lion. If you don't go to sleep early enough, it's going to be hard to wake up early enough. A person has to strengthen themselves like a lion. Umiyad kishayer mishnaso, as soon as they wake up from their sleep, yokum bizrizos, they should get up with alacrity, lavodas abore, to serve their creator, yizbarach, viyasara, right, their elevated creator, kodem shiyizgabra vayetzer, and do that before your yetzer hara comes to you, v'tanos v'toanos v'vayokum, before your evil inclination gives you all sorts of reasons why you shouldn't get out of bed. Parenthetically, the Mishnah Brura, and from my understanding, it's also scientifically true, not that I know so much about this, that it's better to wait a short period of time before getting out of bed, just because otherwise the blood like rushes to your head and that's not so healthy. The Mishnah Brura definitely says that, and from my understanding that's actually medically correct too, although I don't know. Anyone want to agree or disagree?
I read about that somewhere, but in the internet, so I'm not saying,
okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. Not an official source, but okay, that could corroborate it. Fine. The evil inclination might come to a person in the winter and say, "Eich takum ata baboker hashkim? Why are you getting up so early in the morning? V'akor gadol, it's too cold outside." V'kayitz yasiyanu, and in the summer, the evil inclination will come to a person and try and convince him, "Eich takum imitasla? How can you get out of bed? V'adayin lo savata mishnasecha? You haven't yet had enough time to sleep." By the way, parenthetically, once we're talking about the evil inclination, you know, saying you've had enough sleep, it is important to note that sometimes the evil inclination tells us not to get enough sleep. That there's actually a Tosfos, that there's one Gemara which says that God created the moon for learning Torah. So we would have light, we'd be able to study Torah at night. And there's another Gemara which says that God created the night for sleep. So the Gemara asks, what is it? Did God create the night for sleep, or did God create the moonlight so that we could stay up at night learning? So Tosos answers, it depends. You have the long nights of the winter, and you have the short nights of the summer. The short nights of the summer, that's intended for sleeping. The long nights of the winter, so there, a person should spend part of the time learning by moonlight. So that's how Tosos resolves that contradiction in the Gemara. But what we see from that is that there's an assumption that for the duration of the shorter nights, a person's going to be spending that time entirely sleeping. Now, I guess we have to figure out how long the shortest nights are in Babylonia, but my guess is that that they're not too short. there is an idea that a person should make sure to get enough sleep. On that note, I was reading a book called Power Sleep by someone named James Mass, who's a professor and researches sleep, and he says that most people assume you need to get 8 hours of sleep a night. That's basically true. A person is at 95% effectiveness, whatever exactly that means, on 8 hours of sleep, but actually for 100% effectiveness, a person should really get close to 10 hours of sleep. It's just those extra 2 hours for only 5% effectiveness, most people don't really go for that. But still, and then he also speaks about something called a sleep debt, that if a person gets less than 8 hours of sleep, so they fall behind. They create a sleep debt, and let's say a person gets 7 hours of sleep for an entire week. So they've lost 1 hour each night of the week, so they've lost 7 hours of sleep. That's like one night. That's as if they got 8 hours of sleep each night, and one night they only got 1 hour of sleep, because they create a sleep debt, and that sleep debt has to be repaid for a person to eventually, you know, regain full functioning. Anyway, just another... Shabbos, right, exactly. Hashem gave us Shabbos to rest, as the name says. We're supposed to catch up on our rest on Shabbos. Yeah, it's true. That sometimes gets overlooked, the definition of the word Shabbos. That's why God gave us a day of rest. Fine, so anyway, so back to the arguments of the evil inclination. Right, the evil inclination says, stay in bed. Obetanos acheros, or comes up with other reasons why we should stay in bed. V'chadome. A person should be careful to get up quickly and with alacrity. And now, this is why I brought this source. A person who accustoms himself to doing this, he claims 4 or 5 times is enough. You accustom yourself to doing it 4 or 5 times, it will not be difficult for you afterwards. Not only have you created the habit, but a person who comes to purify himself receives additional heavenly help. So first of all, he's created a habit, which as it is will help him, and he also receives additional heavenly help for putting in the effort to try and do this 4 or 5 times. So this is a great example of how a good habit can create order, which is helpful in our lives. We all have to get up at a certain time in the morning, and if a person gets in the habit of doing that routinely, so then in the future it'll be much easier. Okay, so moving on to the second segment of Covey's introduction. What does it take to form good habits? So he writes here on page 55, for our purposes, we will define a habit as the intersection of knowledge, skill, and desire. And he explains what that means. Knowledge is a theoretical paradigm, the what to do and the why. In other words, the habit that I want to develop and the why that habit is important. Skill is the how to do it. Meaning, it could be I know what habit I want and why that habit is valuable, but I still need to know how to carry out that habit. And desire is the motivation, the want to do. In order to make something a habit in our lives, we have to have all three. So the Orchos Tzadikim brings a nice metaphor for this. The Orchos Tzadikim only picks up on two of these necessary components to habit. He doesn't mention the component of skill. Covey is correct in pointing out that you need that component as well. But I like the Orchos Tzadikim's metaphor. So he writes, Yish kamar b'nei adam, you have people, asher ta'avosam lispos derech hatov. They sincerely want to take the good path. They want to do what's right. Ve'einam yodim atov lahem, but they don't know what's right. They think every day that they want to attain this high level, but they never attain it. It could be for two reasons. A person doesn't realize their faults, perhaps, or their weaknesses. They don't know what they're doing wrong. In other words, they don't know what habits they should be pursuing. They don't have what Covey calls the first category here, knowledge. They don't have the theoretical paradigm, the what to do and the why. They don't know what their weaknesses are and what they should be doing to improve. And what can that be compared to? It's like one person, Reuven, is looking for Shimon, but he doesn't know what Shimon looks like. We can look for him all day, but he's not going to find him. He could frequently walk right past him, but he won't recognize him. Kena adam azeh. So to this person, afal pishu choshev tamid mayaseh mechapes maaseh atov. He always wants to improve. He's really motivated to improve. Lo yasek, he's not going to improve. Kevan she'eno makir chasrono, because he doesn't know his weaknesses and he doesn't know what areas he should be working on improving in. He doesn't know what habits to pursue. A person needs to know what habits they want to run after. V'yesh adam, and there's another type of person, sheyodeh hamidos haraos sheyesh, but he knows what bad traits he has, he knows what he has to work on, he knows what habits to pursue. V'choshev latzeis mehen, he wants to get out of his bad habits. V'reachos b'midos tovos, and to grab on to good characteristics. V'gam hulo yasek kol yamav haderech hayasher, he may also not attain the proper way. Machmashem itzatzer lechapes hamidos hatovos karoi, because he's not putting in enough effort, he doesn't have sufficient motivation. V'hudoma, and that's comparable to a case, l'ruvein shemechapes Shimon u'makiro, to Ruvein who's looking for Shimon, and Shimon could be his best friend, and he knows what Shimon looks like. V'afal pikein eino motzo, and nonetheless he doesn't find him, mach mashe eino mechapes ozo karoi, because he's not searching for him properly, he's not putting in enough effort to try and find him. So the Orchos Tzadikim picks up on two out of Kovi's 3 points. He picks up on the necessity for knowledge, for knowing what habits one wants to build, and on the importance of motivation, on being properly motivated to pursue that habit. And of course, we have to add in what Kovi says, the third point, the skill, how to do what I want to do. Just for the sake of not making too long a source sheet, so I didn't bring a few more paragraphs that Kovi continues there, but he gives an example for skill. Let's say a person realizes the value of listening skills. So he knows what. He knows that there's the what and the why. He knows he wants to improve his listening skills and why that's important. He could be fully motivated, but he might not have the skills for how to do that. That there's a way to improving one's listening skills, maybe to not feeling pressure to respond right away. There's another book that I really like, written by a man named Richard Carlson. It's called Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, and it's all small stuff. So he talks about the fact that the conversations become very intense when both parties in the conversation are always thinking about what they're going to say next. If I'm spending my whole time just thinking about, well, you said that and I want to respond this, but you're still talking, so I'm waiting for you to finish talking so I can tell you what I already decided I wanted to tell you a minute ago, so then there's a pressure. The conversation becomes very high-pressured. And the conversation can be relaxed to a great degree if a person listens without trying to think so much about what he's going to say when the other person concludes, you know, what they're saying.
But then he's going to forget what he wanted to say.
There has to be a balance. You're right. There has to be a balance. You're right. That's true. A person can't be oblivious to what they're going to, you know, reply to what the person is saying, but they also can't feel a pressure. So that's an example of where, you know, you can have the knowledge, you can know what the habit is that you want to build, listening skills, and you can be fully motivated, but you still need the skill to know how one builds listening skills. Like, let's say this particular idea, that not feeling a pressure to reply can help a person, you know, listen patiently while the other person is speaking. Fine. So moving on to the next quote here in Seven Habits, he writes, page 55, it's at the bottom of the second side of the first sheet, it's sometimes a painful process. It's a change that has to be motivated by a higher purpose, by the willingness to subordinate what you think you want now for what you want later. But this process produces happiness, the object and design of our existence. And by the way, that's also a Torah concept, and Mesilas Yesharim says that God created the world for the sake of giving us pleasure. And that's true both in this world and in the next world. God wanted to give us pleasure in this world and wanted to give us pleasure in the next world. For the sake of attaining pleasure in the next world, he gave us Torah and mitzvos, through which we earn our reward in the next world. And he also wants us to enjoy this world. We see there are psukim that say that the Jewish people were punished for not serving Hashem with a sense of joy. So and we make blessings before we eat, you know, to fully appreciate, you know, what it is that we have and to thank God for giving it to us. So as Kovi continues, happiness can be defined in part at least as the fruit of the desire and ability to sacrifice what we want now for what we want eventually. In other words, in order to put in the effort to attain these good habits, we have to be willing to sacrifice, you know, what we might want in the moment for, you know, what we want eventually, what we eventually want to become. And that really is an explicit Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah says here in Source 10, V'havei mechashev hefsed mitzvah keneged schara. If we're presented with the opportunity to do a mitzvah, so we should calculate the loss that we incur for performing the mitzvah. Maybe it's an inconvenience or whatever the loss might be. I wanted to do something else. Now I'm going to, instead of doing what I wanted to do, I'm going to perform the mitzvah. So there's a loss incurred. And we should calculate that and realize that that's the price that we pay, that's the expense for the ultimate tremendous reward that we're going to get for performing the mitzvah. Ruschar Aveira Keneged Hefseda. We should calculate, you know, the pleasure, the benefit that we might get from violating an Aveira right now, and compare that to the terrible loss that we're going to suffer, you know, in the future as a punishment for violating that Aveira. So this idea that we sacrifice what we want now in order to attain what we want eventually is really this idea in Pirkei Avos. Fine. So moving on to the next segment of Kovi's introduction, he talks about the maturity continuum. The people are born being dependent, and actually the Cholos HaRavavos writes that that's actually a blessing for us. Because if we were, what he says, I take that back. What he says is that it's a blessing for us that we don't, that we haven't reached our full intellectual capabilities when we're born. Because if we had, we would feel so terrible over the fact that we're so dependent. Imagine someone with full intellectual faculties being as dependent as a newborn infant. So that would be very painful. So it's actually a blessing that we're not, that our brains aren't fully developed at the time that we're born, because dependence and full dependence, like an infant is something that would be painful for an adult. So a person begins being dependent, and then they move on to becoming independent. They can take care of themselves. And then Covey's main point here is that the highest level is realizing the value of interdependence. So Kovi writes, it's easy to see that independence is much more mature than dependence. It's much more mature to be independent, to be able to take care of oneself. And that's expressed in the Gemara in Brachos here in Source 11. Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar de Amri Tarvayus. Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar both say, Kevan shenetzdarech adam lebrios. Once a person requires the help of other people, panav mishtanos kekrum. So sometimes that's humiliating. Now, I don't think he's saying that it's inherently wrong. It's inherently, you know, a bad thing to be dependent on other people. But the Gemara means to say that it can be humiliating to be dependent on other people. We all need help as in various areas, as we'll see from the continued sources. You know, a person can't do everything in the world themselves. We'll see a Gemara later on that talks about how, you know, we buy clothing, we buy food, we don't you know, shear the sheep ourselves, we don't plant the wheat ourselves. We all need to receive assistance from other people, and that's why Covey points out that the ideal is interdependence. So I don't think the Gemara means to say that someone who needs someone else's help, you know, is inherently problematic. We all, to some degree, rely on interdependence. But it's humiliating. Shnei Amar, the Gemara says, quotes a pasuk, Kirum zulus livnei adam. So what does that mean? So the Gemara interprets, my kirum. Oh, so first of all, it's a drasha, livnei adam. When a person needs other people, so then they become like a crumb. So what's a crumb? So the Gemara says, ki asur avdimi amar of echad yesh bekrachay hayam uchrum shemau. There's a bird by the islands of the sea, a faraway bird, uchrum shemau, and it's called a crumb. When the sun shines, so it reflects many colors. In other words, it's humiliating. A person's face can turn colors. It's humiliating to need other people's help. And Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Asi, the Ami Tavayu, Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Asi both say, Kihu nidon bishnei dinim. It's as if a person is judged by two punishments, so to speak. Eshu mayim. It's like a person is punished in fire and water. Shenemah, as the pasuk says here, kavta enosh roshenu. You cause another person to like ride on top of us. Banu be'eshu v'mayim, and we came into fire and water. So it's embarrassing to be dependent on other people. And Seven Habits, Covey continues here in page 57 in the next quote. He writes, if I were emotionally dependent, my sense of worth and security would come from your opinion of me. And then referring to someone who's independent, he writes, emotionally I would be validated from within. I would be inner directed. My sense of worth would not be a function of being liked or treated well. And it's clear that being independent emotionally is valuable. That a person is not relying on other people for their own self-worth. That's something that's very important. The Kotzker Rebbe said a famous statement, which he said in Hebrew. He said, I'll just read it here in English because I translated. He said, I'm not what I think that I am. I'm not what you think that I am. I'm what I think that you think that I am. Which means that a person mistakenly evaluates themselves based on how they think other people perceive them. And I think that the Kotzker Rebbe meant to teach two things. First of all, he meant to teach that we should go out of our way to show people who we love and respect, that we love and respect them. Because it's very nice that I love and respect someone, but if they don't know that I love and respect them, so it's not going to help their self-esteem. It only helps their self-esteem if I, you know, express that idea that I love and respect them. So I think the Kotzker Rebbe is first of all telling us to be, you know, good friends, good family members, etc., and to really, you know, to really demonstrate how we feel towards other people. But I think he's also talking to the person themselves and saying to them that a person shouldn't make this mistake. A person shouldn't make their self-worth dependent on what other people think of them, or even more than that, dependent on what he thinks other people think of them. Actually, this happened to me once. It was funny. I was speaking to a friend of mine in Yeshiva University, and he was telling me about how highly he thought of one of the rabbis in Yeshiva University. And it was nice. He went on and on about how he had so much respect for him. Then a few days later, I was talking to that rabbi, and he said, "You know my student," and mentioned the friend, "I have so much respect for him." So, you know, I bridged the gap with the compliments. I told each one what the other one said about them. You know, so we don't even necessarily know what someone thinks about us. Someone might think very highly about us. We don't even know it. So a person, it's beneficial to not to base one's self-worth on what I think someone else thinks about me, for two reasons. First of all, because my self-worth is not dependent on what someone else thinks about me. It's dependent on, well, everyone has immense self-worth because we're created in God's image. But also, I have no idea what someone else thinks about me. Actually, I'm in school now for social work in Wurzweiler and NYU. So one of the cognitive distortions that people frequently make, a mistake people frequently make, is what's called mind reading. I think that he's thinking this. So who knows? I don't know what he's thinking. He might be thinking something totally different. Fine. So moving on. So Stephen Covey writes, by the way, my plan is, we didn't write an end time. My plan is to finish at 9. If anyone has to leave early, that's fine. And, you know, but that was my goal. I didn't write an end time to this year, but we will finish by 9. I will make sure, because I'm sure people are...
grab a quick coffee.
Of course.
Can I get what you want?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, I do one coffee a day.
Okay, thank you.
So I do it in the morning. I used to do 2 or 3 coffees a day, and fast days are very difficult for me. So I got off of coffee a week or so before Yom Kippur. Then I was going back and forth: should I get back on it or not? Because it is helpful, and they say there are medical benefits to coffee. That is what they say, with moderation.
And what type of decaf afterwards?
That's smart, because you do get a little degree, you know, small degree of caffeine with decaf.
You get all the health benefits.
You get all the okay. That's good to know. Thank you. Okay, so I got to go to decaf. Look at that.
Just want to make a comment about the Kotzker Rebbe story.
Yeah.
I heard the same thing, didn't realize Kotzker Rebbe is the source, as like in a parenting class a million years ago, that, you know, you don't say to your kid, oh, you see them do something good and say, "You're a good boy, I'm so proud of you." You say, "You did a good thing, you must be proud of yourself."
Right? Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah, so it's sort of like, not setting that trap of the kid thinking that what's important is what my father thinks of me. It's more important than what I think myself.
You're educating them to base their self-worth on their own recognition. Yeah. That's great. That's good. Yeah. Okay. So I'm learning a lot today. I'm learning. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back. I shouldn't say as a neder. You know, I don't know. If I have the self-control, I might go back to decaf. And when speaking to my kids, that's a good point. I always say, you know, "You're such a good boy. You're such a good girl." You know, so I really should say, you should realize, you know, you realize yourself that you're such a good boy, you're such a good girl.
You did a good thing, yeah.
Right, good. Thank you. Shkoyach. Fine. So moving on to Kovey's next point, page 58. Life is by nature highly interdependent. So the highest level, according to Covey, is interdependence. To try to achieve maximum effectiveness through independence is like trying to play tennis with a golf club, right? That's not going to work. The tool is not suited to the reality. Interdependence is a far more mature, more advanced concept. If I am physically interdependent, I am self-reliant and capable, but I also realize that you and I working together can accomplish far more than even at my best I could accomplish alone. If I am emotionally interdependent, I derive a great sense of worth within myself, but I also recognize the need for love, for giving, and for receiving love from others. If I am intellectually interdependent, I realize that I need the best thinking of other people to join with my own. And I think interdependence sometimes works in two different ways. Sometimes interdependence works when people work together on a project. And that we see here in Source 12, the Pasuk says in Koheles, Tovim hashnayim min ha'echad, two people are better than one, asher yesh lehem sachar tov ba'amoram, they will get a greater profit in their work. And it says here, the Psikta Zutarta, I think I saw this, when you bring a source from Bar Ilan, they tell you, I think I got this from a Rashi or a Metzudas David. But it came down as a psikta zutarta. Okay? Anyway, so it says, Tovim hashnayim min ha'echad, Al pshuto tovim hashnayim haasukim bepragmatia mino echad. So it means two people doing business are greater than one. Zebifnei atzmo. Meaning two people doing business together are going to have greater profits than if each one of them were working independently. Meaning, it's not teaching us very much to say two people working on a project will accomplish more than one person working on a project. That's fairly obvious, right? I mean, unless the two of them are going to fight all the time and not work. But assuming two people are both working, so they're obviously going to accomplish more than one person working. The point is that two people working together will accomplish more than if each one of them were working independently. Asher yesh lehem sachar tov ba'amolam, right? And they'll receive profits in their work. But not only that, interdependence is also, it's not only when two people are working together on a project, but it's also life in general, the concept I guess you'd call of paying it forward. You know, someone does something for you, and you do something for someone else. That's how society works in general. People do things for us, we do things for others. And that can be seen also in a pasuk in Koheles. Here in source 14, Shlach rachmecha al pnei hamayim, right? Send your bread onto the waters, ki v'rov hayomim timtza'enu, because eventually you'll find it. And Rashi explains, in source 15, Shlach rachmecha al pnei hamayim, asei tova v'chesed la'adam shiyomer lecha ribcha arav al tir'enu od. You should do favors and kindness for someone who your heart tells you you're never going to see again. And that's comparable to this metaphor of throwing your bread onto the water. You expect never to get it back. But the pasuk says, "Ki berov hayomim timtza'enu," that eventually you will get it back. Od yomim boim, there will be a time that will come with the kabel tashlumcha and you'll receive your reward. Re'ema ne'emar b'Yisro. Look what happened with Yisro. Yisro said to his daughters, "Kiren lo v'yocharachem." Right? They said an Egyptian man, which we know to be Moshe Rabbeinu, saved us from the people who were driving us away from the well. So Yisro said, "Listen, this Egyptian man did you a favor, so call him in. Invite him to dinner." V'savar shu mitzvi. He thought he was an Egyptian who he would never see again. He gave an Egyptian wanderer, a meal. V'lo yirenu od. Maha yasofo. And what was the end of the story? Nasa chosno u'melech al Yisrael. So in the end, Moshe Rabbeinu became Yisro's son-in-law. That he already benefited that way. And then Moshe Rabbeinu became the king of the Jewish people. V'chniso tachas kanfei hashchina and brought Yisro close to God. V'zachu banav uvnei banav reshe v'rishkas agazis. And the Gemara tells us that Yisro's descendants eventually sat on the highest rabbinic court. So Yisro thought he was just inviting an Egyptian for a meal. He thought he was doing a favor. At the end, it worked out for him. So that's what life is. Life is interdependent. You do something for someone, you help out other people, and other people help out you. And that, yes.
So would you say the interdependence would be on a higher madriga than dependence? Independence.
Yes.
Interdependence, where you're working with somebody else, so you're one person benefiting from the other, rather than being fully independent.
Yeah, so I think that is...
Where would independence overrule interdependence?
I'm just thinking out loud. That's a fair question. I'm just thinking out loud. The reason why I think Covey says that interdependence is a higher level than independence is because that's how he understands, and I think he's correct, that's how he understands reality. Meaning that's what life is. Meaning life is interdependence. So if we were to look for an example of where independence is greater than interdependence, that's the question. So I'm just thinking out loud. We would have to find an example where life in that domain really is strictly independent and not interdependent. If we found a domain in life where a person really doesn't need anyone else's help,
an example.
Right, that's the question. That's hard.
That's an interesting question.
Yeah. Any ideas?
Well, sometimes people work better alone. There's different types of people, right? Sometimes people work better with people. Sometimes.
Oh, that's true. Right.
I don't know.
So, in one particular area, it could be that a person would do better working independently.
Mm-hmm.
And Covey means then that in a broader life context, we're always interdependent for other things, right? And I think perhaps the next Gemara is a good example for that. We mentioned earlier. For time's sake, I'll just say it outside. This idea that where we buy clothing, we buy food. We don't go through the whole process of planting food, and we don't go through the whole process of shearing the sheep. Let's say you have someone this is your example, that you have someone who, let's say, excels in a particular field. I mean, if we were to say that all the accountants, have to start working together with all the lawyers in law, and all the doctors have to start working with all the accountants in accounting is probably not as productive as if, you know, the accountant just stick to doing his accounting and the doctor stick to his medicine, you know, etc. So a person can excel in a particular field, and they might not benefit from other people's help in that particular project that they're working on. I'm just, you know, repeating your point. But I think that makes sense.
There might be a bigger goal than that, an interdependence. There might be the underlying factor could be a sociological factor where people should be getting along and people should be understanding to discredit like independence where you sort of aloof or alone or, you know, isolated.
Right.
There might be sort of another theory behind that.
Right. The social benefit, meaning what you're pointing out is perhaps, if I understand correctly, that let's say you have a lawyer working together with the accountant on the accountant's accounting project. Well, it could be that the accounting project is going to take a lot more time, but you've just developed a friendship which could last for life. That's true.
Or also, to the different example, in wills, for example, the lawyer and the accountant have to work together. Otherwise, you have big problems.
Sure. So I guess some tasks require people with different skills coming together. Yeah, that all makes sense. Thank you. Fine. So moving on to the last page here. What Covey calls the P/PC balance, production and production capability. So he writes here on page 61. This is a long quote, but it's all good. They, referring to the seven habits, are also habits of effectiveness because they are based on a paradigm of effectiveness that is in harmony with a natural law, a principle I call the PPC balance, which many people break themselves against. In other words, a lot of people don't realize this important concept. This principle can be easily understood by remembering Aesop's fable of the goose and the golden egg. This fable is the story of a poor farmer who one day discovers in the nest of his pet goose a glittering golden egg. At first he thinks it must be some kind of trick. But as he starts to throw the egg aside, he has second thoughts and takes it in to be appraised instead. The egg is pure gold. The farmer can't believe his good fortune. He becomes even more incredulous the following day when the experience is repeated. Day after day, he awakens to rush to the nest and find another golden egg. He becomes fabulously wealthy, and it all seems too good to be true. But with his increasing wealth comes greed and impatience. Unable to wait day after day for the golden eggs, the farmer decides he will kill the goose and get them all at once. But when he opens the goose, he finds it empty. There are no golden eggs, and now there is no way to get any more. The farmer has destroyed the goose that produced them. I suggest that within this fable is a natural law, a principle, the basic definition of effectiveness. Most people see effectiveness from the golden egg paradigm. The more you produce, the more you do, the more effective you are. But as the story shows, true effectiveness is a function of two things: what is produced, the golden eggs, and the producing asset or capacity to produce, the goose. If you adopt a pattern of life that focuses on golden eggs and neglects the goose, you will soon be without the asset that produces golden eggs. On the other hand, if you only take care of the goose with no aim toward the golden eggs, you soon won't have the wherewithal to feed yourself or the goose. Effectiveness lies in the balance, what I call the PPC balance. P stands for production of desired results, the golden eggs. PC stands for production capability, the ability or asset that produces the golden eggs. So first of all, that's so true. And second of all, I think we see three areas in Torah sources where this is really expressed very, very clearly. First is the story in Malachim. Shlomo HaMelech was a very powerful king, right? King Solomon, you know, reigns, you know, with a strong arm. And when he passed away and his son Rehoboam took over, so the people came to Rehoboam and they asked him to please go easy on us. And Rehoboam wasn't sure what to do, so he asked his advisors, and he asked his older advisors and his younger advisors. And his older advisor said, you should listen to the people, they've worked hard under Shlomo HaMelech, you should go easy on them. And his younger advisor said, show them who's boss, be tough on them. And Rehoboam decides to go with the advice of his younger advisors. And the pasuk says, V'ata, and now, Avihem Misarechem Ol Kaved, Rehoboam says to the people, my father put a heavy burden, a heavy yoke upon you, V'ani Osif Al-Ulchem, and I'll place an even heavier burden on you. Avi Yisar Eschem Bashotim, my father, you know, gave you, castigated you with sticks. Vani Ayasar Eschem Akrabim, and I'll use scorpions. So he decided to follow the advice of his young advisors and to be very tough. So why did he do this? So one explanation for why he did this, what I always used to think was the only explanation, and now I realize it's one of two explanations, but one explanation is he thought that the best way to achieve compliance, to make sure that everyone is obedient, is to be tough, like the teacher on day one. You know, the teacher on day one wants to make sure that everyone behaves themselves for the rest of the year, so very tough. That way you're sure, you know, people, they see you as being strict and they listen. So that's one possibility. But the Metsudas David has another possibility here in Source 18. Ve'atah. And now. Why does he begin the sentence? Why does Rechavim begin the sentence with "and now"? So the Metsudas David explains, Ho'il v'tigdal ma'alasi, since my Rechavim's level will be more elevated, Osif od ulchem, I'll have to add on to your yoke. Ki od yisrabu an nashai v'susai, because I'm going to have more men and more horses, v'aleichem v'chalkel, and you the people, have to support them. Yaser eschem, and I'm going to chastise you with scorpions, remaros de machsoro, to fill all my needs. In other words, the reason why Rechavim decided to be harder on the people than Shlomo HaMelech was not only because that's what a teacher sometimes does on day one to achieve obedience, but because he had greater needs. He had more chariots, he had more people in his entourage, so he said, listen, I need more golden eggs. That's what he said he needs. And what ended up happening? So of course the people rebelled and the kingdom split. And the Gemara even discusses his mistake. The Gemara here in Source 19 says, Tanya Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Omer, Im yomru lecha zekeinim sesor, if the elders tell you to destroy, v'yeradim tell you b'nei, and the youngsters tell you you should build, sesor v'yal tivne, listen to the elders and destroy, and don't listen to the young children to build, v'vnei shastira zekeinim, because the destruction of the elders, binyan, that in truth is building. U'binyan ne'arim, and the building of the youngsters, that in truth is stira, that's really destruction. V'simen l'davar, and how are we supposed to remember this? Rechavim ben Shlomo. Rechavim, this story of Rechavim, that he wanted to... He was told by the youngsters to build, to increase his entourage, you know, with making the people do more work, to increase the production. And that was a mistake, because he decreased the production capability. So this is an example of where we see this idea in interpersonal relationships. That if a person is going to try and get too much from somebody, so that person is going to say, you know, I'm not interested. So we see in interpersonal relationships the importance of developing, you know, developing a friendship. And what I don't mean to say here, by the way, just to take a step back, there's a book which... got a bad name because of its title, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Carnegie. Right? Carnegie, exactly. So it's a great bestseller. I think it's a fabulous book. If you read what he actually writes carefully, you see that he doesn't mean that a person should be superficial. He doesn't mean the person just do what they need to win friends and to influence people. He talks a lot about the importance of sincerity. But I don't mean to say here that a person should just befriend someone because then, you know, they'll be compliant to your needs. But it's important that when developing relationships, so we have to realize that it's not just about, so to speak, the production, that, you know, we want something out of the relationship. It's also about production capability, that we want to develop the relationship to maintain the relationship. And I don't mean in a sinister way. I mean, you know, let's say even within family, in order to maintain, you know, a positive family relationship. So even if a person, you know, let's say, you know, wants a child or whatever it is to do something at a particular time, if they're going to make such a point about how that they have to do something right then and there, so they're sacrificing on the production capability, and then the child might not be so eager to do things in the future. We also see this idea of the PPC balance in religious cases, and we will conclude in 2 minutes on time. In Source 20, the Gemara says, famous Gemara, Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh, Omer, v'shamru b'nei Yisrael ha-Shabbos. The Jews should observe the Shabbos. Omra Torah, the Torah says, chalel arav Shabbos achas, a person should violate one Shabbos, kadesh yishmor Shabbosos harbos, that he can observe many Shabbosos in the future. In other words, in a life-threatening situation, we put the Shabbos aside, we violate Shabbos to save a person's life. Why? So one of the reasons why we do that is because violate this Shabbos means giving up on the production, so to speak, giving up on the performance of this Shabbos in order to fulfill many future Shabbosos. That's in order to have the production capability to be healthy and well to fulfill many future Shabbosos. And we also see this idea with regard to what I guess you would call Bein Adam Wa'atzmo, that a person's own self-care, that I'm not going to read it inside, but in terms of the importance of getting enough sleep, which we discussed earlier, so the Taz here basically says that you have some people who they study Torah later into the night, and as a result, they're very tired the next day, and it could take them 5 hours the next day to accomplish what someone who got a good night's sleep can accomplish in 1 hour. And the Taz encourages a person, get a good night's sleep, you'll be able to concentrate the next day. That's an example where if a person is going to sacrifice their production capability, their ability to, you know, to perform the next day, just in order to get more production, you know, more golden eggs, you know, that night, to be able to study more that night, it's not worth it. So I hope everyone enjoyed this learning together, and Yirtzeh Hashem will continue next week with the first This was the introduction with the first chapter of Stephen Covey, which was about being proactive. Thank you, everyone, for coming.